Welcome to Foul Players Radio, your podcast for arts, entertainment, and pop culture. My name is Michael Spedden, your host. Every episode features interesting people with fun, fascinating stories about their journeys in the performing arts. Authors, actors, musicians, dancers, athletes, comics, you name it. Sit back, relax, and have a listen. Let's have some fun. Foul Players Radio is a proud production of the Foul Players Group and a proud member of the SJ Network. And welcome back to Foul Players Radio. Tonight's guest is Billy Van Zandt. Billy Van Zandt is the author of Get in the Car, Jane, Adventures in the TV Wasteland, and it's been called the television equivalent of William Goldman's Adventures in the Screen Trade. It's a behind-the-scenes memoir of Emmy-nominated writer and producer Billy Van Zandt and his years making America's favorite and not-so-favorite sitcoms. He has produced and or written for many sitcoms, such as Nurses, Daddy Dearest, Martin, The Hughleys, Yes Dear, The Wayans Brothers, Bless This House, Anything But Love, New Heart, and the special presentation of I Love Lucy, the very first show, and Suddenly Susan, just to name a few. His book is filled with first-hand observations of Lucille Ball, Brooke Shields, Frank Sinatra, Don Rickles, Martin Lawrence, Andrew Dice Clay, Richard Lewis, Bob Newhart, Jamie Lee Curtis, The Wayans Brothers, Richard Mulligan, Alan Arkin, D.L. Hughley, film legend Dorothy L'Amour, Broadway legend Elaine Stritch, Rosie O'Donnell, Oscar winner Olympia Dukakis, Penny Marshall, and Matthew Perry, among many others. Part behind-the-scenes gossip, part textbook, all truth. A funny insider's look at Hollywood, as well as an invaluable and insightful guide to writing and producing sitcoms, Get in the Car, Jane is a book for everybody who's ever been passionate about their work and frustrated with the obstacles they need to overcome just to do their job. We will also discuss some of his acting roles in movies, such as Jaws 2, which he has some great stories from, very interesting stuff in that part, and in television, in Life with Lucy. I really enjoyed this episode. Billy gives us a real perspective about what goes on behind the scenes of a sitcom. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with Billy Van Zandt right after these words.
Are you looking for a one-of-a-kind gift this holiday season? Or is your decor just missing something? How about a flatfish? What's a flatfish? Blue Earth Works, a pottery studio based in Wilmington, North Carolina, produces flatfish along with other handmade, functional, and sculptural pottery. Each piece is handmade, so everyone is unique and a little surprising. Remember, if you're able, please support a small business this holiday season. Shop online at blueearthworks.etsy.com, or if you're in Maryland, head on over to Kathy's Corner Shop in Northeast Maryland at 100 South Main Street and ask to see The Flatfish by Chaz. They'll know what you mean.
Hey, what's up? This is Christopher Stolle of Realm of the Mist Entertainment. The podcast you are listening to is part of the SJ Network. Go to s-j-network.com. That's s-j-network.com for more great podcasts and information on those shows, as well as information and ability to contact publicist Steve Joyner for more information. Just go to the website and check out the family. Ladies and gentlemen, until then, enjoy the show.
Hey everybody, it's John Orlando from the PBD Cast. Are you wondering where you can find my podcast? Well, it's real simple. Just go over to pbdcast.com, the online home of yours truly, or it's available through all of those major podcasting platforms. Just search for it in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Spotify, iHeartRadio app. And don't forget that every single Monday night at 8 o'clock, I do a live broadcast of the week's episode of the PVDcast through the Facebook page. Just go over to Facebook.com and search for at PVDcast and join me every Monday night at 8 p.m. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to get on out of here. So I'll chat at each and every one of you later.
The holidays are here, and we have a fantastic gift idea. Foul Players Radio guest Barbara Bustard has just released a book. It's called The Art of Healing, 12 step-by-step meditative art exercises for improved physical, mental, and spiritual well-being. Art offers a way to process all that we experience in life: joy, sadness, excitement, anger, and everything in between. Art allows us to work through the stress that underlies all disease. The meditative exercises in this book are enjoyable and engaging. They are described in a very simple, clearly articulated manner and are appropriate for any level of artistic experience. It's available on Amazon for $29 and has gotten many positive reviews. Again, the title of the book is The Art of Healing, 12 step-by-step meditative art exercises for improved physical, mental, and spiritual well-being by Barbara Bustard. Pick up your copy today.
So, Mr. Billy Van Zandt, it's a pleasure to have you on Foul Players Radio today. I just finished reading your book, and what a read. So, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Glad you liked the book, too.
Oh, it was absolutely brilliant. I told you beforehand, there was, you know, a lot of parts I really, really liked. And I could kind of identify with what you went through. Not that you and I have had the same jobs over the years, but, you know, I still have my day job, and I have those same frustrations that you kind of went through with the networks and everything. So, I really, you know, I have a lot of questions about the book and everything once we get to that here. But I would like to start off with Jaws 2. That was, I believe you said, your first film.
My first movie audition as well.
Oh, is that right? Is that right?
Yeah. So I didn't know what to expect. I got cast. I was excited because everybody knew the first Jaws, of course. Mm-hmm. And so they flew us up to Martha's Vineyard, where we had a great director named John Hancock. And after 4 weeks of learning to sail and getting tan, which was part of the job, and rehearsing, we started shooting. Maybe we got, I don't know, 4 or 5 days into shooting, and then suddenly everybody went home.
Okay.
a couple weeks later, I got a phone call saying, you're now going to Florida to finish the movie. So I flew to Florida, where I met a new director. Carl Gottlieb was brought in to rewrite the script from scratch, and a whole new cast of people. And So it was a night I didn't have to fly to California to re-audition. A lot of the actors did. So it was sort of a shock the first day I walked in, and it was like, who are these people? You know, and my role shifted too. In the first version, I was Robert Shaw's son, and I had a great death scene where I was swimming towards shore, and all of a sudden I'm pushed towards shore, and Roy Scheider grabs my hand and pulls up the top half of me only. And that was my death. Mm. And when they rewrote it for the second version, they tamed my death a little bit. So they were going to have the bottoms of my legs chewed off, because somehow that was less cruel, I guess. I don't know. And so we went to shoot that. And then they started panicking about the rating of the movie. And if it was an R-rated movie, they would lose money at the box office. And a certain number of deaths constituted an R rating. So they had me swim up on the rocks as an alternate ending, and we still shot a death scene. And I didn't know till I saw it in a movie theater whether I lived or died in the movie. The death scene that we filmed was great. They did it with a stuntman first, and I saw it in dailies, and I got mad they didn't use me. So I went to the producer, and I said, I want to do that. And he said, no, you can't do that. I said, I want to do that. The guy doesn't look enough like me. I want my big death thing. I want to do it. So David Brown, the producer, said, okay, we'll let you film it, but it has to be the last thing we shoot. I said, why does it have to be the last thing we shoot? He said, in case you die. So they put me on the pontoon of the boat. They had ropes around my waist. They had scuba divers underwater. And the shark, the whatever it weighed, a couple of tons, I thought, a piece of metal came crashing down on top of me. And right before it hit me, the scuba divers yanked me underwater. And that was my death scene. Mm. And it was only afterwards, looking back at it, I thought, well, that was the stupidest thing I ever agreed to do. but so in the final shot of the movie, the camera pulls back and you see all the kids on Cable Junction, but you don't see me. And nobody catches this because I'm dead at that point. But they had me swim. So I must have swum all the way around to the back of the island. And that's where I am hiding out, I guess, in that last shot.
Oh, that's wild. Yeah, it's interesting to hear things that have, you know, happened like that, that, you know, most people don't really know about, that there were a couple of other endings to it and everything. Yeah. So you did, they did start filming that in Long Beach, California, was it? It's said in your book.
No, we started in Martha's Vineyard in
Hendrickstown. Okay.
And then we shot the bulk of the film, probably maybe 9 months of it, in Pensacola, Florida.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And then we ended up in Long Beach for the month of January only. That's when we did a bunch of pickup shots. And that's when they filmed me swimming up on the rocks and living. it was my first introduction to California was when I came out to do Jaws 2.
Oh.
And, my big glamorous introduction to Hollywood was swimming in polluted waters outside a cat food cannery in Long Beach. That was my introduction.
Did nobody look at that before you shot there, or was just the location that perfect that they had you put up with?
Well, they didn't care. And we were all young and stupid, so we didn't, you know, jump in the water. It's polluted. Okay, we'll do it. And they put drops in our ears every time we got out of the water. So it was like,
oh boy.
Know, I don't know if I'd get away with, they'd get away with doing that now, but back then we were all pretty naive.
Yeah, I'm originally from Baltimore, and whenever we have an out-of-town team come in, you know, the Orioles have been pretty bad the last couple of years, and whenever somebody comes in from out of town, usually get a bunch of drunks that come in that are out-of-town fans. Right. They always walk past the harbor, and somebody always gets drunk and jumps in, and everybody's like, no, don't jump in there.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you get out of there, you're going to need about 50 hepatitis shots. And
I'll tell you, after the first Jaws, I never went in the ocean again. I don't like going in the ocean. For some reason, shooting the movie in on the Gulf of Mexico, that seemed like you were in bathwater or something. It wasn't scary. If we had shot that on the Atlantic Ocean, it would have been horrifying. And there were sharks all around us when we were shooting the thing. The locals didn't like us being there. So they were chumming in the water on purpose to try and bring sharks in to get rid of us.
Oh, my God. Jesus.
And again, we were so naive. The producers would say, don't worry, we have scuba divers with dart guns if any sharks come near you. Oh, we go, geez. Okay, and we jump in the water.
That had the same impact on me. When I saw the posters for the first Jaws, I was about 6 years old. That's when it came out in 75. And I just saw the proportions of that shark next to the woman swimming on the ocean on the top.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like, I'm not going anywhere near the ocean. And it was like that for a while, you know, a couple of summers, I wouldn't go anywhere near the ocean. And my grandparents would take me to the beach, and I was like, I'm not going in there. And then finally, you know, I came around to it, and then I was good with it for a long time. But then they started showing these aerial views on the news of these shark attacks. Mm-hmm. And then you could see just past where people were swimming, like dozens of them all over the place. So I'm kind of leery about going back in now, you know.
Well, I was leery growing up because I grew up on the Jersey Shore.
Oh, okay.
So, one of the first big shark attacks that was off of Asbury Park, and it was a guy named Van Zandt, apparently, but no relation. I don't know. Yeah. So that makes me think twice before I get in the water back there.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can imagine. I can imagine. Well, you're not too. Grew up going to Ocean City, Maryland, which isn't really very far from the Jersey Shore, yeah. Truthfully. One thing I wanted to ask you too, and I was just, I didn't know if you had known this from, you know, being around, you know, the writing, or I know you were an actor in this one, you didn't really write it, but it seemed to me like there was a little bit of back and forth between the Jaws and Orca movies because they were both out around the same time. And in the Orca movie at the beginning, if you've ever seen it, a great white shark is stalking those scientists out on that boat. And then an orca comes out of where and kills the shark, you know, like bops into it. The shark goes flying through the air. Then in the movie you were in, Jaws 2, what did they find on the beach? An orca with giant bites out of it. Plus,
that's right. You know, I think we were first. I'm not quite sure. Was Orca with Bo Derek?
Yes, yes, yeah. Bo Derek and Richard Harris.
I think that was their way of saying, you thought a shark was scary, wait till you see this.
Oh, okay.
But conscious thing there at all, I don't think.
Okay, I was just curious if you know, maybe you had known or anything. So you had mentioned, too, that there are certain ratings based on, you know, they said the movie ratings go up based on how many people die in the movie?
Well, this was in the 70s.
Oh, so, it was back then. Okay.
78. And I remember Verna Fields, who she edited the first Jaws, and she was a big executive at Universal. She fought very hard to get us a PG rating. But and I remember her saying, because I said to her, I said, wait a minute, I don't remember what movie it was. I just saw a John Wayne movie where the entire town blows up. There's more people dead in that than there is in our film. Why come that gets a PG and we get an R? And she said, because the audience doesn't know the people that got killed. That was the criteria for the rating.
Interesting.
I mean, you look at things like Midnight Cowboy is an X-rated movie. There's nothing in today's standards that's X-rated in there. So it's all arbitrary. Depends who's in charge at the time.
Interesting. Okay. So what I wanted to do now is kind of get into your book, and I kind of like, the early chapter, I Stalk Lucy.
Yeah.
Apparently, growing up, you had said that, Lucy was one of your, I guess, heroines, you enjoyed watching her. You learned a heck of a lot from her, as far as comedic timing and comic acting and, everything. So tell us a bit about that, and, how you kind of came to meet her after a while.
When I was a kid, growing up in New Jersey, the stations out of New York that we'd get would show I Love Lucy 4 times a day and the Lucy Show twice a day. So I watched all of them. And I was always into TV. I was one of those little psycho kids that would actually circle the TV guide for what I was going to watch through the entire week. Mm-hmm. And back when there was a TV guide where you could actually do that. Mm-hmm. I started watching it because it was just funny to me. And then I started really studying her timing, and I studied the writers' scripts and how they structured each script, and how, no matter how outrageous it was believable, and the show, you knew everybody loved everybody on that show. It was a real family feeling, and all those things hit with me, and I knew I wanted to do that kind of comedy. So I studied and studied and studied. And when I first came out to California to do the Jaws 2 thing, I went straight from the airport to her house because I wanted to meet her, and today we call that stalking. But back then it was just being a fan. And so I went to her house. Jane, she was my girlfriend at the time, my writing partner of 46 years that I talk about in the book. We drove straight to Lucy's house, and I started to get out of the car, and Jane said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I have to meet her." And Jane hid under the dashboard as I walked up the brick walkway, and I knocked on the door, and houseboy answers the door. And I said, "Billy Van Zandt's here to see Lucille Ball." And he said, "She's not home." Slammed the door in my face. I got in the car. We drove away. 10 years later, I was very lucky to not only have met Lucy, but became a little friendly with her. And I guess I did a little tiny 4-line guest spot on her last TV show, and I was invited to her house to watch the premiere episode of the final show. So we were sitting in the house, and I asked her, we were talking about a whole bunch of things, Buster Keaton, the Three Stooges, and all that. And I said, "Did you ever meet Charlie Chaplin?" I said, I know you imitated him in a bunch of your shows. You can see his timing and your timing a little bit, but did you ever meet him? I never saw a picture of you." And she said, "No, but I'll tell you a funny story. I found out where he lived in 1976 when Gary and I were in Switzerland. So we drove over to the house, and I started to get out of the car, and Gary said, 'What are you doing?' I said, 'I gotta go meet him. And Gary hid under the dashboard, and I walked up the walkway, and I knocked on the door, and I said, 'Lucille Ball's here to see Charlie Chaplin.' And they said, 'He's not home,' and slammed the door in my face." It was a very surreal moment for me, I guess.
Oh, wow. It's almost the exact same thing.
Almost exactly the same. Yeah. Yeah.
And then you got to get in to see her rehearse.
That was what a masterclass that was.
Oh, I bet.
My friend Ann Dusenberry, who was in Jaws 2 with me, she got cast as Lucy's daughter in the final series. And she immediately called me and told me, that she knew I'd want to know. And I jumped on a plane and I came out to visit. And I walked onto the soundstage, and Ann came up to me and said, "Billy, I just found out it's a closed set. You can't be here. No one's allowed in the studio while we're rehearsing. I'm sorry." And I said, "Oh, it's fine." And I then snuck up the back, and I went up to the back of the bleachers, and I sat up there hiding. And all of a sudden I saw Lucy come in, and they were going to do a table reading of the week's script. And I see Lucy look up, and she sees me up in the bleachers. And I thought, "Oh man, I'm going to get Ann fired. I didn't know it." And Lucy got up, and she walked up to the front of the bleachers, and she looked up at me, and she said, "Hi, Billy, I heard you were coming." And for the rest of the week, it was a closed set with one exception, me. I got to sit there and watch her rehearse, and it was fantastic, just fantastic.
Oh, I bet that was just I bet you really did go to school that week, huh?
Really did. I really did. And while she was so smart, she was, mm-hmm. while she's in a scene with somebody, she's pointing to a light behind her to say that light needs to be refocused. And she moved people around for better camera angles than the director was giving them. She was bossy, but she knew what she was doing. Mm-hmm. She liked to work, which I love. She was first one there in the morning, last one to leave at night. And I was a kid in a candy store that week, let me tell you.
I bet. Well, and she and Desi Arnaz were really kind of revolutionary with the way they filmed their TV show back in the 50s too. They did a lot of things that nobody else had even done before. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. They invented the sitcom as we know it today. He shot it with multiple cameras. That was new. It was done with a live audience because he knew Lucy would be better with a live audience. That was not done at the time, mm-hmm. for TV. They put it on film, so they didn't have to have lesser quality kinescopes going back mm-hmm. and forth between the coasts. And by doing that, he invented the rerun because you have pristine prints of what they filmed. Mm. Desi Arnaz was a really incredible giant in the TV business, and he never gets enough credit as far as I'm concerned.
I agree with you. I really do agree with you on that, you know. So you ended up getting to work. Well, one thing that you did, you know, you got to work on a show of hers a little bit later on. But the one thing I wanted to ask you a bit about, and I bet this was a real honor for you, you got to host the show where they unearthed a pilot for yeah. I Love Lucy. So tell us about that. I mean, you must have been in your glory.
Oh, man, this was great. This was, it was a year after she passed away. We were in development with a man named Bud Grant, who had been president of CBS, and now he had a production company. Mm-hmm. And his girlfriend, this is a little complicated, but I'll try and make this make sense. His girlfriend had been a student when she was very young to this dance teacher. The dance teacher was married and widowed, married to Pepito the Clown, a very world-famous clown, a Spanish clown that was friends with Desi Arnaz, and guest starred in the pilot episode. So as a thank you present, Desi gave him a copy of the pilot. Well, no one had seen the pilot in 40 years. Everybody thought it was completely lost. Bud Grant and his girlfriend were at this woman's house for Thanksgiving, and the woman started showing home movies, and all of a sudden the I Love Lucy pilot came on. Mm. And they flipped out, and he ran into our office the next day and said, "You know, he just found this." And Jane said, "Well, you don't have to ask Billy, and I'm not going to get a choice, so we're doing this." Mm-hmm. And we went to CBS. We said, "We have the footage for the I Love Lucy pilot." They said, "Great, we own it." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Yes, we know, but we want to do an hour special because it's 35 minutes long, so we need another, you know, we need another 20 minutes so we can fill it with the story of I Love Lucy and how it got put together." And they said, no, we're going to cut it down to 22 minutes. I said, "No, you're not." And they said, "Well, we own it." He said, "Yeah, but we have the film. And if you want the film, you're going to give us an hour." So we sort of blackmailed him.
There you go. And,
they didn't think we could pull it off because they wanted it in 2 weeks for sweeps. Mm-hmm. And luckily, I knew all the interviews that Lucy and Desi had done through the years. So I knew where to pull Lucy talking about it and then Desi talking about it. And then we got Lucy Arnaz to come in and host the evening and mm-hmm. fill in the gaps. So it was a pretty great special. I was really thrilled with it. And we were the highest rated show of the year, which was pretty phenomenal.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And that must have been a real thrill. It must have been an absolute thrill for you. And so you ended up working on, I think, the last show that she had.
Yeah, that was the one. Yeah, that was Life with Lucy. That
Life
was
with Lucy.
The bleachers. Yeah.
Right, right. And you had Gail Gordon in the cast as well as John Ritter. Do you have any memories of working with those guys?
The crazy thing for me is, talk about a kid in a candy store. It was written and produced. It was written. The episode I was in was written by Arthur Marx, Groucho's son.
Yeah.
It was directed by Mark Daniels, who directed the original I Love Lucy and Star Trek's. Mm-hmm. It was produced by Bob Carroll Jr. and Madeline Davis, who created I Love Lucy with Jess Oppenheimer. Hmm. So talk about a kid in a candy store. And then Gail Gordon, sweetest man you ever met. Just sweet as could be. And he, I got cast in a little four-line role. Mm-hmm. And the first day I walked onto the set, he made a point of coming up to me, waiting for me when I came in. He came up to me and put out his hand and said, welcome to the family. That was pretty cool. John Ritter, I was in an episode that we saw at Lucy's house. I didn't work with him on that episode. I was in a different episode. But he was at the house when I went to see it. And sweet, really sweet guy. I ended up writing for him on Anything But Love. I think we did two episodes that he guest starred in, because he was the producer of that show. Really great guy. Really great guy. And I know Lucy adored him because he did the same sort of stuff she did, you know.
He was probably one of the better physical comedians probably in our, you know, lifetime that we would have seen. Very funny physically. And but I just heard that, you know, from a lot of other people that he was just really nice to work with. You know, when you got an opportunity to work with him, you really had something, you know.
It's true. He was sweet, really sweet guy. And the truth is, and I guess everybody sort of knows this, but the star of the TV show sets the tone for your entire experience. Mm-hmm. If you had somebody who's tough to work with, it's rough. And if you have somebody like John Ritter or Lucy or Bob Newhart, who I had the pleasure of working with, or Don Rickles, it's a joy to go to work. You can't wait to get there. Mm-hmm. And everybody I know who's worked with John just adored him.
Oh yeah. That's what I've heard so many times. So, looking in, yeah. And you had worked on, quite a few sitcoms. But I wanted to ask you about a theater job that you had mentioned in your book. I think it was called Drop Dead, and you had in the cast, Rose Marie, Barney Martin, Donnie Most, you know, your former Mrs. Adrienne Barbeau, and you and Jane in the cast. And God, if I could go back in time and get tickets for that, I would love to have seen that. I bet it was hilarious.
It was so funny to the point where we all became completely unprofessional about halfway through the run. And we just tried making each other laugh on stage any chance we could to little tweak something to make somebody try and laugh. It was so much fun. The funny thing was originally I tried to, it's a potboiler murder mystery spoof, really. Mm-hmm. And it's a bunch of bad actors putting on a murder mystery in the hopes of reviving their career. And somebody gets killed in the first act, and the show must go on because they don't care about the guy that got killed. They just want to be discovered again. All this stuff goes on. So Jane and I had done it in New York off Broadway with John Mack, who was also in the cast out in LA, and Glenn Kelman. And then we cast everybody else out here in LA. And the first person we went to was not Adrienne, was Tina Louise from Gilligan's Island to play the has-been TV star.
I'd read
and
that.
Her agent said she's not playing a has-been, and that was the end of that. So luckily, Adrienne came onto the show, and then suddenly, you know, we started dating afterwards, and we got married and had our kids. But a couple of years ago, we were in New York for one of the big CBS anniversary parties, and I said, Adrienne, there's Tina Louise. Let's go tell her the story, you know. Mm-hmm. So we went up to her, and I said, you know, if it wasn't for you turning down my play, I never would have. And that's as far as I got. She said, what play? I said, it was called Drop Dead. So anyway, you turned it down. And then Adrienne, when was this? I don't know. It was, you know, a couple of years ago. Anyway, so anyway.
She ruined your story.
she went nuts. Where'd you send the script? I said, I don't know. You send it to your agent. That drunk, he cost me so much work. And then we just went back the way. We never finished the story to tell us. So, but anyway, when Adrian and I got married, I got a telegram from somebody saying, good thing you didn't cast Tina Louise.
Yeah. Anyway,
I became so close to Rose Marie and Barney Martin. Everybody knows from Seinfeld. I played the father. We're very loyal to the actors we work with through the years, whether they're on stage or in TV shows. So any chance we had to work with Barney, any chance we had to work with Rose Marie, I brought her onto the Hughleys to guest star, and she ended up on Suddenly Susan. But man, we had so much fun. There was one night we were all so crazy in that show, just trying to make each other laugh. We would do things like, okay, it's Jerry Lewis night. Everybody has to work in some impression of Jerry Lewis somewhere in the show, and we'll see who wins. And Craig Bierko, another giant in the business now, he won. He did a very long Hey Lady at one point while he was running around. And it was really fun. We had a ball. And the audiences kept coming back. We'd see the same people in the audience all the time because it really was a free-for-all on stage.
Oh, wow. That's kind of near and dear to my heart because I run a murder mystery company myself down here in Maryland. And we perform on trains and boats and for dinner shows and that kind of thing. And it's because there's a storyline, but all the dialogue is improv, you know, constant breaking the fourth wall with people. They're constantly breaking our fourth wall, so we don't really have a choice. But it ends up being a lot of fun.
I've got good friends who do murder mysteries up in New Jersey. And, I got talked into one. I don't know when this was. It was way back. I got talked into doing one because somebody didn't show up. And so it's like, okay. So I go down to do the thing, and I'm getting changed in a closet where they keep the dishes. And it's like, wait, what am I doing here? And I think they gave me a script, and I had to make improv the whole thing. And they said, "Okay, you have one speech at the end where you're going to become possessed." I said, "I do what?" And he said, "You're going to become possessed, but I don't have any of the special effects stuff with me. So you're going to drop behind this podium, and there are two sponges there, and you're going to put blood in your eyes and come up and finish the thing." It's the last murder mystery I ever did.
That's the fun part, though, you know, that's that's the fun part. And I wanted to ask you a bit, too. You had a show that you were putting together with, Penny Marshall, and it had involved Olympia Dukakis, eventually Richard Mulligan after a couple of choices there, and then Michael McKean. Tell us about this experience here. It was you were developing it with her, right?
Yes, there was a British show which was quite a smash. I think that ran in 10 years in London called Waiting for God. And it's about people in an assisted living place. And, you know, they're basically waiting to die there, I guess. And the lead woman is a photographer who broke her hip and she doesn't want to be there. She hates the whole idea of it. And she meets this guy played by Richard Mulligan in our show, who's very Walter Mitty, very fantasies, trying to, you know, live as much as you can before you can't live anymore. And everything we did on this show was exactly correct. Mm-hmm. It was one of the proudest things I've ever done. And Penny had gotten the rights from England. And then she got Olympia Dukakis on board. And then the two of them came to us and asked us if we would actually write it and produce it. So we did. And then I tell the story in the book about how Richard Mulligan came in. That was not, that was not easy, although it was the exact right choice to make. And then Michael McKean, everything he did was funny. He's one of my favorites. I love
him. He's wonderful, isn't he?
Great. And Julie Haggerty from Airplane and America. And, I would have bet the world that this show would have run 10 years, but that was the one year the one year in the history of CBS they decided they didn't want to skew old, and our show was too old for what the audience they thought they were going to get, so they didn't pick us up. So they paid us all off. Every one of us had deals that, you know, 10 cents more, we could have filmed the whole series, but they paid us all off and we went home, and it was it was torture that it didn't go. But man, I loved working with Olympia. I worked with her a couple times since.
Yeah.
I haven't had the pleasure of working with Michael again, but not that I wouldn't. Man, he's funny.
Mm. How about you had worked with Richard Lewis a few times on a couple of things too, and it was hilarious because it seems like he's like his persona in real life. I mean, it seems like you just get Richard Lewis. I mean, with the
that's pretty much what you get. That's pretty much what you get. He's a little neurotic, and he's made a very good career out of it.
Yeah,
but the first show we worked on was Anything But Love with Jamie Lee Curtis, and I wasn't in charge of that show, so I didn't have to. You know, I just knew Richard as a funny guy in the show and a nice guy. And then we did Daddy Dearest with Don Rickles and Richard Lewis. Richard actually came to Jane and me and asked us to write it. And suddenly I was on the producer end, you know, and not just a staff writer on the other show. So I suddenly got a lot of faxes. People were faxing things all night long back in those days. So he would always have a better joke for the script. And it was like, well, couldn't it wait till tomorrow? No, here, you know. And it became a running joke with me and my wife at the time of, you know, could we get through one night without a fax coming? Mm-hmm. And he was always trying to make the show better, so I can't fault him for that.
Oh yeah,
pretty funny show. And I'd work with them again. I just think he's a ball, but he's a little neurotic.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I could just imagine. I could imagine after a while you just wanted to throw that fax machine out the window because it seemed like it was coming through at like 4 o'clock in the morning and stuff while you're trying to sleep. And
yeah, exactly.
That's too much. How was Don Rickles?
The greatest person I've worked with, period. I loved working with him. The sweetest guy in the world, probably tied with Bob Newhart, and I can see why they were friends. Mm-hmm. Don was, he was quiet and respectful and just a nice guy until he knew there was an audience. And the second there was an audience, he turned on the nightclub, Don Rickles, and he would do 20 minutes at a drop, you know, with a waiter coming over to the table. He'd just stop and rip the guy to shreds and the whole restaurant would be laughing. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, he'd go back into being quiet little Don again. Mm-hmm. But we had so much fun on that show because of him. When you rehearse a show, you usually have an empty soundstage with, you know, the bleachers that will be filled with an audience on Friday when you shoot it. But ours were packed because people from all over the studio would come into our soundstage and sit up there, because I didn't forbid anybody coming in, because they wanted to be insulted by Don. So, you know, it was like a badge of honor for people. Hey, he insulted me today. He made fun of my hair. Okay, great. Yeah. And we had one time, it was probably one of the best shows we shot. So we had fights with the network. It was at the beginning of the height of political correctness, and we were doing a show with Don Rickles. So mm-hmm. you can see where we had problems. They kept trying to soften his character and soften the show. And we was like, no, we got Don Rickles. We want to go over the line. And so it became a tug of war. And Richard ended up having an anxiety attack, what we thought was a heart attack in the middle of one of our tapings. So we didn't tell the audience because we kept thinking that the PA that we had sent to the hospital, throw him in the car and get him here. That's how nice I am. We kept getting updates that, you know, he wasn't coming back. But by then we had a full audience full of people. We had shown them the pilot episode on film. And we knew we couldn't shoot the show because Richard wasn't coming back. They were going to keep him overnight just to watch him. So Don did an hour's worth of nightclub for them all. It was pretty phenomenal. And it was frustrating for me because it was probably one of the first episode. I don't know, we were maybe six episodes in. where we finally, we nailed it. We've got it this week. This show is fantastic. And the audience, we never got to do it. But we had shot enough scenes during the day that we pieced it all together for the final show. But I got Hunts Hall out of retirement from the Bowery Boys.
Yes.
He got him out of retirement for a spot in that. Garrett Morris came in and did a guest spot on that one.
Oh, yeah.
And somebody else. It was a jam-packed episode full of funny stuff. And thank God we had we had good rehearsal during the day that we shot. We'd sometimes shoot things during the day just mm-hmm. so we could get through it faster at night. And yeah. Thank God we did, because we were able to put the whole thing together. And Howard Storm was our very funny guy who you guys would know from his Woody Allen movies as an actor. Mm-hmm. Great director, and he directed that episode and did a great job with it.
Wow, that's something. And then you, speaking of political correctness, I think right after that you worked with Andrew Dice Clay.
yeah.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
That
was well, we worked with him twice, actually. The first time was on a show that never got on the air called the Ralph Macchio Show, starring Ralph Macchio.
Right.
Also a very nice guy. Liked him a lot. Like mm-hmm. him a lot. Andrew's career was waning, let's say, back then. Mm-hmm. And he dropped the Dice out of his name. And he came onto that show as Andrew Clay, as Ralph's cousin, who had maybe one scene a week. We did six episodes of this. And by the end of those six episodes, Ralph Macchio's show was not getting on the air, but Andrew Dice Clay was. He was mm-hmm. so funny, so really fantastically funny. And so a show called Bless This House was created by Bruce Helford, who created the Drew Carey Show at the same time. And the odds of getting one show on the air or remote getting two on the same at the same time is insane. Mm-hmm. So Bruce decided he would produce Drew Carey, and he had Jane and me produce Bless This House. And suddenly it's Andrew Dice Clay again, but and I will say he was hilariously funny. It took him a while to learn the scripts, which was frustrating because it made you expect them to all the actors to know their scripts by Thursday because mm. you're shooting it on Friday. He always had problems on Thursday. And so it took me a couple shows to realize he was just stalling because he didn't have the lines there.
Right.
Man, he hit a home run every time he was on front of the camera. And, the one week we had Elaine Stritch on the show to play Kathy Moriarty's mother.
Oh boy.
And Elaine Stritch, I was told ahead of time, don't hire her. She's a pain in the ass. And I said, it's Elaine Stritch and she's brilliant and she's legendary for a reason. She's good. So I hired her to play Kathy's mother. And she came in and I'll clean up the language here. She,
you can say whatever you want.
Okay. she showed up and the PA picked her up at the hotel. Good morning, Ms. Stritch. She said, there'll be none of that. I was like, uh-oh. So he shut up. He got her to the rehearsal. We introduced her. Everybody was excited to have her there. And she stood up and said, before we start, do you want me to reread the lines I rewrote in my room last night, or do you just want me to read this shit? And we said, please just read our shit.
Oh, man.
And that started our week. And she had them throw out there was a couch, and we had a nice dressing room for her. What's this couch doing in here? You think I'm here to entertain people? Get it out of here. That was how we started the week.
Mm.
But she was brilliant. It was the best episode we did of the season. And so there was one, she was having trouble with some line, and Jane and I went down to the set, and we see Andrew sitting off in the corner, and I thought, wait a minute. I said, Andrew, all week long, you've been on time. You've known your lines. You're as professional as you can be. Normally, you're doing this, you're doing that. And what's the difference? Why this week are you so professional? And he pointed to Elaine Stritch and said, there's only room for one. but he was fun. And we got the ratings were great. It was a very good show. We got canceled. while we were still doing well, because I think Andrew pissed somebody off at CBS, and out of the blue, they just canned the show. A year later, not that it was the same show, but it still hurts a little bit. King of Queens came on the air in our spot a year later with the, you know, playing a postal, you know, I was a postal worker in our show, and God love them. They ran for 10 years with it, and we did not even make the full season, but it was still a good show.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I can imagine. I can imagine. Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, it, from what I read about it and everything, I mean, it's, you know, you had all the right parts and everything. It's just a shame that those things happen. And,
it's all, every time you do it, it's just out of your hands. You do the best you can. And it's so arbitrary when people get canceled or they want this replaced, or some people, you know, fire that actor. Why? Because, oh, they want to put their mark on the show and say that they helped save the show, even though nothing wrong with the actor you had to get rid of. Mm-hmm. A lot of stuff that goes into it. And
there is, you know, I mean, even
saying that no matter how terrible a TV show is that you see on the air now, mm-hmm. I have full respect for whoever created that show to get it on the air, because I know the hoops they had to jump through to get there, you know.
It
doesn't always end up the way you want, and most of the time the ones that end up really great, like let's say the Sopranos or Seinfeld, they're all left alone because nobody thinks they're going to be successful. And then suddenly they're a big hit, and surprise, they don't have to take your notes now.
Yeah. Do you ever sit around and think about sometimes what could have been with some of the shows that you've had that just ended up, you know, not continuing because of all these crazy things that happen, you know, that you don't have control over?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I would love a house. And, you know, I'd love a summer house I could go to because the show ran for 20 years. The weird thing is I've never felt like I didn't do my best, therefore we got, you know, I didn't feel like I did such a bad job, I understand why we got canned or something. I really put everything into every show we did. Mm-hmm. Now the only left turn that my career took was I started out as an actor. I only wrote to give myself something to act in. Mm-hmm. And then one of the last big auditions I had, I guess, was for Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And it got down to Judge Reinhold and me for the role he got. The two of us at the callbacks. And sometimes I think, if that had happened, that would have opened. I probably wouldn't have gone into TV writing, and I would have just been an actor. But I'm happy with the route I ended up on, but still would have been nice, you know, that was like. Mm-hmm. Not that he wasn't great in the film, maybe he was.
Mm-hmm. Sure, but I mean, there's just so much that everything has to go through. I mean, even to get cast as an actor, I mean, you know, you've got to get approved all the way to the top. You know,
yeah. And the frustrating thing now is when I started, you were hired to be the creative person, mm-hmm. and they left you, and the only time you heard from anybody is, you know, you can't say damn in this show. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. That was it. Now it's so micromanaged because mm-hmm. they've lost their audience, so they're grasping to try and get it back, mm-hmm. I guess, that, you know, if I had a show running right now, I couldn't cast a one-line walk-on role without having three people on videotape that I send to the studio to get mm-hmm. their permission to cast that person.
Yeah.
It's so frustrating. So and now you have people who, with all due respect, have never done comedy, have never performed, have never directed. You have these business people basically giving you notes on your scripts, which I never used to get. Mm. And now you'd get, you know, I think you could do a better joke on page 6. Oh, really? Really? How many have you written? You know, so unless you're lucky enough to be Bruce Helford or Chuck Lorre, you know, nobody tells them what to do at all, you know? And that's why their shows are successful.
Right. Right. Now with, some of the shows that, you know, you had worked with and produced and everything, you know, that ended up, you know, not continuing for one reason or another. I mean, the era that your book takes place in is, looks like it's like late 80s to late 90s, maybe early 2000s or so.
Yeah.
even, you know, that was when, you know, we did have cable TV with a lot of networks on it. You know, would there be, could you think of any projects that you would have liked to have taken maybe to a Netflix or an Amazon that you, you know, if you would have had the resources to continue, you know, let's say if CBS didn't want to do it, but you still had the ability to continue producing the show, but take it somewhere else. Are there any shows that come to mind that you would have liked to have done that with?
The Olympia Dukakis show, for sure. I still think that was just brilliant. Not because of me, just it was, everything about it was correct. That one for sure. And there's actually a 1 hour drama that we wrote and couldn't sell. There were too many historical things taking place at the time we tried to sell it. That one I would love to, that's based on New Amsterdam in New York City, you know, back in the Dutch days where my people were there.
Yes.
And that one I would, that would be a great Netflix show. But yeah, I'll tell you what I love about Netflix and Showtime and all those other things now, Amazon Prime, is you don't have to do 29 episodes a year, because that's grueling. No matter how good you are, it's grueling to be able to do 10 episodes and go home every you know, the quality just is huge on that, because you don't, you're not killing yourself those last couple episodes. Somebody just mentioned the other day, one of the sitcoms, they said, why are there 8 writers' names on this, you know, teleplay by, I said, because they ran out of time to write the script, and all the entire staff sat in a room and wrote it so they could get it out in time, because it, you know, the season's over and they're all exhausted.
Right.
To do 10 episodes, I'd still like to jump in and do that.
Wow. That's great. Interesting. Interesting. So I just had a couple more questions for you here, before we wrap it up. So you are kind of in a showbiz family there. I know you have your brother, who's, you know, we all know very well, is little Stevie Van Zandt from the Springsteen band. And, you know, great musician, you know, great job they've done over the years. And he's quite a guy too. He's quite a philanthropist. Did I say that right? Philanthropist.
Yes, you did. He is probably the hardest working man in show business, I think, between the E Street Band, his own band, you know, all the serious radio channels that he runs, and his syndicated radio show, the Underground Garage. Plus he has a record label with all these new bands on it. And, he's producing for other people, Darlene Love, et cetera. So, you know, thank God people get married and die in my family. Otherwise we'd never see each other.
Right, right, right. And your sons are involved in show business too, aren't they?
Yeah, the funny thing is I did not come from a showbiz family at all. My father,
you and your brothers were the first generation of the showbiz family, and now they've come from you, is what I meant.
And thank God he went through it first, because he went through hell with my father, I'll tell you.
Oh yeah, well I went through it myself. Yeah.
Yeah, but so 7 years later, when I said I'm going into show business, it was like, well, okay, go ahead, good luck to you. one of my sons is a music producer, writer. He just got his first gold record this year, which is pretty cool. So he produces for Atlantic and Def Jam Records. And he just did one with, what's the guy's name? I'm going to blank. Ty Dolla Sign. I love these names. Ty Dolla Sign and Nicki Minaj, called Expensive. That's one of his. So he's doing great. And my other son, Walker, is a streetwear designer. So he's doing great. And my stepson, Cody, his mother, Adrienne Barbeau, it was her son from her first marriage. And John Carpenter, the horror movie legendary director, he's the father. Mm-hmm. And Cody is an incredibly talented musician. He's actually co-written all the new Halloween movie themes and got new albums all the time. So yeah, we are a show business family. Who knew?
Yeah, that's great. That's great. So one other thing I wanted to ask you, I know you've done it, you have a good background in theater. You know, you've written a lot of plays, and One thing I kind of like to ask my guests for fun is, you know, when I have bands on, I kind of ask about Spinal Tap moments. Actors, I kind of ask about, you know, I guess what we call war stories, or whenever something, if you've ever had anything incredibly wrong happen on stage.
All the time.
If you had maybe a story or two of that you'd like to share with us for fun, you know.
We did our play Silent Movie. Silent Laughter. We did that off Broadway. And that's a silent slapstick comedy done live in front of an audience. And it's done in black and white. And we had costumes of gray and white and black and all this stuff. And title cards over the actors' heads with the actors' dialogue on it. And we had a big Wurlitzer organ playing all the music to it. And in one of the scenes, Glenn Jones, who's in most of our shows, is my sidekick. He slid his arm on a piece of the prop in an assembly line thing, and he started bleeding. And my only concern was getting him off stage because it was the wrong color. It was going to ruin the show. So I shoved him off stage. and the same show, this was horrible. I had, there was a World War I scene. So I had a big, you know, a World War I metal helmet on. And I was supposed to toss it off to the wings at one point, and there was nobody there to get it. And I, out of the corner of my eyes, before I had LASIKs, I see somebody over there, and I toss the hat. And what I didn't realize is it was our costumer, had nothing to do with, and the thing clipped her right in the eye. And thank God her sight is still okay. But somebody keeps saying, if you don't get hurt during a Billy and Jane show, you're doing it wrong. I also slit my wrist in the middle of Arsenic and Old Lace once. I took the glass. I played the Mortimer, the Jimmy Stewart character. I took the glass out of the guy who was about to poison himself, and I slammed it down on the table, and we had real glass, and it slit my wrist. So I saw myself bleeding, so I quickly wrapped it in a napkin and started cutting dialogue so I could get off stage. And the two old ladies, the two ladies playing the old ladies, they thought I just was lost, and they kept bringing me back to the material that I was cutting. And I was on stage four times as long as I would have if I had just done the scene and gotten off. And so he patched me up backstage and shoved me back out on stage. That was a good one. And a Night at the Nutcracker, we did it. This was actually fun. It was the Marx Brothers at the ballet. Is basically
oh, wow.
Just how that was. you can see a clip of that on YouTube. I don't even know what it's called. Night at the Nutcracker Highlights or something. Anyway, the guy playing the male lead, juvenile lead, I set a trampoline in the middle of the stage. So when he's doing his ballet number, he could bounce on it and fly up in the air. You know, it was pretty funny. Except this night, he came down and he clipped his foot on the edge of the trampoline that was built into the stage, and he broke his leg. Uh-huh. So he goes off stage and he's sitting and his leg's already swelling up, and all the other actors are polite enough to like, get him out of the way. I have an entrance, that kind of stuff. You know? And, so our choreographer, a woman who had been watching from the back of the theater, saw what happened. She ran down. We threw his costume on her. She came out, did the dance that was coming up right in time to the music, because we didn't miss anything. She did the dance. She went off. And then people in the audience were like, boy, he looked a little different there. But, you know, and then he staggered back on stage to do his last line and take a bow for the dance that she did. Mm. That was pretty good.
No, that's great. Yeah. You haven't performed until you've had one of those happen. You know, that's your rite of passage, I think. Being able to grab the steering wheel of that car that's spinning in the grassy median on the highway and putting it back on the road is just
it's true. And it's amazing how fast you can think when you have to.
Oh yeah, you really do. You really do. That's really something here. So well, look, Billy, I would really like to thank you for coming on our show today. You know, we've enjoyed having you so much. And
thanks.
I could just, you know, I could ask you questions until the cows come home, you know. But I, like I said, I really enjoyed your book. Why don't you tell us where we can get this book of yours? Go ahead and tell us that.
Sure. It's Get in the Car, Jane, Adventures in the TV Wasteland. And it's all, every chapter is about a different show I worked on that we either created or wrote or produced. You can get it at Amazon. You can get it at Barnes & Noble. And if you go to our website, which is VanZantMillmore.com, you can get a hardcover version autographed. We're selling those on there. And you can follow us at VanZantMillmore.com to see where we're performing next. Because when the world comes back to whatever it's coming back to, we're going to get back out on the road with our 25th play, the Boomer Boys musical. Mm-hmm. And we were touring the country with it before this all went down, and we'll be back doing it again.
Okay, so VanZantMillmore.com is your website. And anything that has to do with your theater would be there as well.
Theater, TV, film, it's all on there in the book.
Absolutely. Well, it's been a real pleasure having you with us today. Again, thank you so much for spending your time with us today, Mr. Billy Van Zant. And thank you all for listening. This is Foul Players Radio, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast is part of the SJ Network. Go to s-j-network.com for more great podcasts and for contact information on publicist Steve Joyner.